give my life and all I have. And I want to know, will you be there?
All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I am once again your guest host here, honored to be standing in for Michael Slate. And we've got a great show for you. A lot of material we're going to bring to you. Several segments. At the end of the hour, I'm going to make some observations on the life and game of Bill Russell, the basketball great, and learning about him and reflecting on how he played his game and insights into the leadership of the revolutionary leader Baba Bacon. This connection will become clear when we get to that section. That's at the end of the hour. Before that, we're going to bring you part three of a really essential, critical, in-depth interview with Raymond Latta. Going into the environmental crisis, the emergency that we face on this planet, and the truth underneath the hype, the lies, the covers, and everything else that's being wool pulled over your eyes about Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and the so-called great move he made, or at least step in the right direction on the climate, which is not true. And Raymond Latta he breaks this down, he exposes the reality. And in this part three, we've been serializing his interview. Part three, he goes into a real solution, an actual revolution, and what that can open up. That is not hype. It is not easy, but it is real. So that's going to be in the middle of the show. Early in the show, the first whole segment is going to be on these beautiful, inspiring, and courageous uprisings that are rocking Iran right now. But before we get into that, and lessons that we need to draw, a few words very briefly, because we don't have much time, but we have to say this. No U.S. NATO war with Russia. No World War III. It is this system, not humanity, that needs to become extinct. We must not accept their future. And I'm talking about the imperialists. I'm talking about Putin and Biden. I'm talking about the Russian imperialists and the U.S. imperialists. The headlines right now are filled with this dangerous, provocative move Putin is making to annex sections of Ukraine, to then be able to claim that any actions that the Ukrainians or NATO forces or U.S. forces takes in those areas will be a direct attack on Russia. That is a major escalation, and Putin has made clear explicitly last week to the UN and then again in the major speech that he just gave that all options, in his view, all weapons are on the table in response to that. That is clearly an indication and a threat of nuclear warfare. But this is not a one-sided aggression from Russia. The U.S. has been backing Ukraine, waging a proxy war, using the Ukrainians as cannon fodder against Russia. Last week was responsible for, engineered, funded, provided key strategic guidance for a massive escalation of the Ukrainian forces fighting against Russia. Biden himself went on 60 Minutes and was very provocative and made clear that he would not rule out any and all options in response. We are on the brink. We are in a situation that could easily spiral into direct confrontation between U.S. and NATO and Russia, with even if it began with tactical nuclear weapons, could easily and quickly escalate into much greater destruction on our planet. We need to say very clearly, this is not a contest, as Biden keeps claiming, between democracy and autocracy. This is a rivalry between two imperialist legit gangsters on a global scale, threatening global humanity. Our interests are not with either of them. People in this country, it is beautiful that thousands have risen up, many gone to jail, many defected in Russia against what their imperialist ruler is doing. But the streets in this country, the people in this country need to pull their heads out of their asses and stop waving the Ukrainian and American flags and stop backing their rulers in this and standing up against the U.S.'s provocative war moves and saying no nuclear war, no World War III, no U.S.-NATO war with Russia. I want to begin with that and point you to the incredible resource page at revcom.us. And without any further ado, let's dive into the beautiful uprising taking place in Iran. Since September 16th, Iran has been rocked by beautiful, righteous, and tremendously courageous protest.
This inspiring struggle has implications for revolution in Iran, for the people there to break free of the oppression of both the Islamic Republic of Iran and of generations of domination, death, economic strangulation, and threats inflicted by U.S. imperialism. There are also profound lessons for revolution everywhere to be drawn from this struggle. It is the responsibility of all of us to not only draw inspiration from their struggle, but to support it and to oppose all attempts to crush it and to misdirect it. All this is addressed in two important statements at RevCom.us, one by the RevComs here in this country and one from the Communist Party of Iran, Marxist-Leninist Maoist. In our next segment, Andy is going to bring that to you. First, a picture of the magnitude of what is unfolding. The outpourings in Iran were sparked after Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old young woman from the Kurdish region of northwest Iran, was taken into custody by Iran's notorious morality police for allegedly violating their laws, mandating that all women wear a head covering called a hijab. While in custody, she suffered a severe blow to the head and went into a coma. 3 days later, she died. Mahsa's death was more than one young woman's life cut short. Her death concentrates generations of enslavement of women by Iran's fascist Islamic fundamentalist regime. This hatred of women is a core pillar of Iran's reactionary and repressive theocratic regime that has disappeared, tortured, and slaughtered thousands who have dared to rise up against it, and which has politically imprisoned dissidents, artists, journalists, feminists, labor activists, environmentalists, lawyers, and communist revolutionaries. It is fury against all of this that is now erupting in over 80 Iranian cities and towns, including in key strongholds of allegiance to the Islamic regime. Those rising up are not just demanding an end to the hijab laws or a few broader reforms. They are tearing down pictures of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, demanding an end to the whole Islamic regime. It is crucial and inspiring that these women have been joined by huge numbers of men. It's spectacular to see the joy with which hijabs are going up in flames, to see students and teachers at more than 20 universities go out on strike, to read about women who themselves still want to wear the hijab, supporting and feeding young protesters, even opening their doors to offer protection when protesters are chased down by police. To see those rising up, refusing to be cowed, even as dozens have been killed. To see protesters saying Mahsa Amini's name all over the world, from Germany to Brazil, from Canada to Cyprus, from Syria to UC Berkeley, the Netherlands, Turkey, Lebanon, Chile, New York City, Belgium, Greece, and far beyond. Our hearts are with the women and men rising up in Iran. Their fight is our fight, and it is from this perspective, and with a profound feeling of responsibility to the women and men rising up, and to the hope that this has ignited around the world, that we share this next segment from Andy.
Righteous, angry, defiant mass protests are spreading across Iran. Over 80 cities rose up on Saturday alone, as women and men with nothing but fists, sticks, and a hatred for oppression faced off against brutal riot pigs and religious fanatics armed with clubs, tear gas, and guns. These protests have grown, intensified, and spread to all areas of the country in the face of heavy and violent repression from the armed authorities of the theocratic and oppressive Islamic Republic of Iran, the IRI. Now ask yourself, what could cause such a ferocious and courageous uprising? For decades, women in Iran have been forced to cover up their bodies and hair with hijab or headscarves, as if their very beings were something to be hidden, confined, and controlled, as if they must be ashamed of their very human existence, all on the dictate of Islamic religious authorities. And if they dared defy this, then they were accosted on the streets by so-called morality police, beaten, and were arrested, and sometimes sent for re-education. Resistance has always gone on against this, but this summer saw the resistance become increasingly public, defiant, and organized. September 13th, when police arrested 20-year-old Mahsa Amini for improperly wearing her hijab, and she ended up dead 3 days later. And when pictures leaked out of her badly beaten body in intensive care, exposing the police lie of a heart attack, it was finally just too much. Dozens of people have been confirmed killed in clashes with security forces. Yet people have reached the point where they are willing to die for justice. Those are our people dancing in the flames. This is our blood running through the streets. These are our hearts beating with the defiance of liberation. Three key points. One, this mass uprising against the Dark Ages theocratic rule of the religious authorities is righteous and needs to be supported by everyone seeking a better world. All attempts at repression by the IRI need to be opposed. The Communist Party of Iran, Marxist-Leninist-Maoist, bases itself on the new communism brought forward by Bob Avakian. The CPI-MLM is fighting, in their words, quote, the struggle to eradicate every form of oppression and exploitation through communist revolution and the establishment of the new socialist republic of Iran. The existence and the work of such a party is a great strength for this struggle and for the people of the world, end quote. As that party declared in their initial statement on these protests, titled Compulsory Hijab and Murder of Women, Key Tools of the Fascist Islamic Republic of Iran to Strangle the Whole Society, they said, quote, the murder of women like Mahsa Amini is an existential necessity for the Islamic Republic. Overthrowing this regime is also an existential necessity for women and for the liberation of all oppressed and exploited in society. The religious, fascist character of the Islamic Republic is embodied in the repression of women who do not give in to servile relationships imposed on it, end quote. Point number two, this mass uprising opens up real possibilities for overthrowing the theocratic regime. It sharply raises the question to millions of what will it take to finally get free? We encourage everyone to go to revcom.us and to read and to spread the statements of the CPI-MLM on this recent upsurge, including their statement, the burial of the compulsory hijab, the burial of the integration of religion with the state has begun. Let's finish it. And to support their efforts to bring forth and lead what is needed. A hallmark and defining feature of the CPI-MLM and the new communism of Bob Avakian is a deep analysis of how the oppression of women is interwoven into the capitalist imperialist system, and how the struggle for the liberation of women and against all forms of patriarchal oppression is a driving force for revolution. The struggle of women to be free of tradition's chains is not something off to the side of revolution. It is a key part, a driving force, both before and after the revolution, of the world process of emancipating all of humanity and a world free of all exploitation, oppression, and antagonistic social divisions. Point three, Joe Biden, as the leading representative of U.S. imperialism and atop the system of capitalism imperialism that enforces these relations of oppression, stated at the U.N. General Assembly in New York, quote, today we stand with the brave citizens and brave women of Iran, who right now are demonstrating to secure their basic rights, end quote. This is complete and utter bullshit, but it is also ominous. First on the bullshit, educate yourself to the actual reality of what the U.S. has done in Iran and to the Iranian people. From 1953 down to today, the through line that marks U.S. action towards Iran is America's attempts, one way or another, to dominate the Iranian people and Iran's resources in service of U.S. imperial interests. This is taking many forms through the years, from carrying out violent coups to brutal puppets, from fomenting wars to sanctions that punished and tortured Iran's people. Biden's statements are nothing but part of a decades-long U.S. attempts to weaken the regime and make Iran and the whole Mideast subservient to American needs and designs. And the Iranian regime's antagonism to the U.S. is not that of a government standing up for liberation, but of a low-level gangster fighting for turf against the big mafia don. Neither the U.S. imperialists nor the Islamic theocrats should be supported. Both must be opposed. And as for supporting women, you need to look no further than Saudi Arabia, the stalwart U.S. ally in the Middle East, which is just as misogynist and repressive as Iran. Indeed, look no further than the U.S. itself, where Biden and the Democrats continually conciliate with the theocratic, Christian, fascist, abortion-outlawing Republican Party. But now for the ominous part. The U.S. regards Iran as a bone in its throat and will very possibly use not only economic and diplomatic pressure, but other forms of intervention, including by working through and with Israel to subvert the Iranian people's struggle and restore outright U.S. domination. These imperialists must not be allowed to pervert this struggle to their own reactionary ends. And as a key part of this, we need to get into and help spread everywhere the news and the meaning of the struggle, as well as the statements and the documents of the Communist Party of Iran, MLM, which fights today for the liberation of Iranian women as part of the overall process of socialist revolution.
Next, we go to an edited excerpt of a speech that Bob Avakian gave in 2017 called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go." In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. As I said, this speech was given in 2017 when Trump was president, but it remains every bit as urgent and relevant today.
In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism. The disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF, the great tautological fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the great tautological fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world, and therefore whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat. Under the influence of the great tautological fallacy, one does not stop to think about the fact that in this situation, North Korea could only be developing this weaponry as an attempt to deter an attack from the United States. For North Korea's leaders know that if they initiated an attack, they would face massive, overwhelming retaliation. And from the point of view of the imperial rulers of the United States, such a possibility of deterrence is precisely the problem, because it could in some measure limit the ability of the U.S. to dominate and dictate. But from childhood, we are indoctrinated with a notion that America is a shining light of freedom, and the President of the United States is the leader of the free world. Well, when has this been true? Was it true during all the years of slavery? Or during the long years of Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, when thousands of black people were lynched while leering mobs of white racists celebrated, and black people as a whole were subjected to constant terror? Is this a shining light of freedom now, when black people have to take to the streets demanding, "Stop killing us," because the police kill 1,000 people every year, many of them unarmed, especially black people, Latinos, and Native Americans? When millions of women are battered and huge numbers are raped every year in this country, is this a shining light to the world? And what is this free world? Does it include the countries where the U.S. has backed and armed military juntas and other oppressive dictatorships with their bloodthirsty death squads terrorizing the people over the last 100 years and more throughout Latin America and many other parts of the world? Does it include today countries such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey, all allies of the U.S. and all ruled by brutally repressive governments? Or what about the Philippines, where the government has carried out the cold-blooded murder of more than 10,000 people within the last year, and the head of state, Duterte, openly boasts of this? Does the free world include Israel, a nuclear-armed state that has occupied Palestinian land in flagrant violation of UN resolutions for 50 years and forcibly maintains over 1 million Palestinian people in Gaza in what amounts to an open-air prison, living barely above survival level and subject to repeated bombardment by Israeli armed forces, which in 2014, with full support from the U.S. government, headed then by Obama, killed over 2,000 people in Gaza, the overwhelming majority civilians, hundreds of them children? Is all this the free world? Once you remove the blinders of the great tautological fallacy, it can be seen that the free world simply means those parts of the world that are under the domination of or are friendly to the United States, no matter how monstrous their ruling classes may be, while the non-free world is made up of those who remain outside of, and especially those who oppose opposition or obstacles to the domination of the U.S. empire. The U.S. government wages war in Africa and Asia, as well as the Middle East, claiming it is fighting to defend civilization against the brutal and murderous Islamic fundamentalist jihadists. But the imperialists of the U.S. are certainly no less brutal and murderous. And the civilization they boast of is literally built on the blood and bones of people all over the world. And why is this Islamic fundamentalism such a force now? Fundamentally, because of the workings of capitalist imperialism itself. Besides the overall role of imperialism in creating more favorable soil for these Islamic fundamentalists, actions of the U.S. imperialists have further fed their growth. In the 1980s, the U.S. actually armed and built up Osama bin Laden and other Islamic fundamentalists to strike at the Soviet Union and Afghanistan. In 2003, in violation of international law, the U.S. invaded Iraq to overthrow the head of government there, Saddam Hussein. This invasion was carried out under the cover of lies that Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. This invasion and the occupation of Iraq by American forces that followed caused hundreds of thousands of deaths, set off bloody conflicts among the Iraqi people, and created more fertile ground for Islamic fundamentalist forces. And the same thing happened in Libya. Under the presidency of Barack Obama, and with the insistent urging of then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the U.S. intervened in a conflict within Libya on the side of forces opposed to the longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi. With the fall of Gaddafi, which was brought about mainly as a result of massive bombing of his forces by the U.S. and its allies, the rivalries and conflicts within Libya were intensified and Islamic fundamentalist forces gained strength. Or take the case of Iran. In 1953, the CIA engineered a coup that overthrew a popular government that was moving to nationalize the oil of the country so that it could be used for the development of its economy instead of being controlled and plundered by the U.S. and Britain. This coup brought the Shah of Iran to power, and the people of Iran suffered decades of torment and torture at the hands of the Shah and his secret police. And here again, these actions of the U.S. created more favorable ground for the forces of Islamic fundamentalism, which ultimately seized power through the revolution that overthrew the Shah in 1979. These are only a few examples of the American crimes that have been committed and the kinds of consequences that have followed from these crimes in countries all over the world. And all this underlines the crucial importance of casting off the blinders of the great tautological fallacy and breaking with American chauvinism. We need to think about humanity first and above all.
That was Bob Avakian, an excerpt of his speech, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go," delivered in 2017. But as you heard it, it is completely relevant today and more urgent than ever for people to understand as the U.S. claims to be the good guys in the world and waging its proxy war in Ukraine against Russia that could easily spin out of control into World War III, a devastating threat to humanity's future, as the U.S. claims to be the good guys supporting the righteous protests in Iran, which are righteous, but the U.S. has no right to speak and no right to interfere. And it is very important that people in this country understand that the U.S. rulers don't represent our interests, and our interests are together with the people of the world. We need to pull out of that GTF, the great tautological fallacy, and recognize that America is not a force for good in the world. So that was Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader. You are listening to The Michael Slate Show. We want to move now to our second major segment. This is part three of an interview that was first broadcast on the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less show at youtube.com/therevcoms. It is Andy Z, the main host of the show, interviewing Raymond Lada on a major piece that he did taking on Biden's climate bill and exposing the reality that the devil is in the big picture and it is not a bill that will help the climate. And this is part three. We played the last two parts, the last 2 weeks, if you want to hear they're in our archives, but let's go right into that now. This is Andy Z interviewing Raymond Lada.
All right, Raymond. So we've spoken about this. The big picture is really the problem of this climate bill from Biden. But now we really need to drill down a little bit deeper. In the article, you write that to seriously deal with climate change, you would have to put the fossil fuel companies out of business, seize their assets, and leave most of the fossil fuel in the ground. And for that to happen, for society to interact with nature in a sustainable way, you need a revolution to overthrow this system, end quote. Well, why is it that you can't make the necessary changes under this system? Why can't we put the fossil fuel companies out of business, seize their assets under this system?
Yeah, look, there are a number of factors here. The most important is what we've been talking about through the course of this interview, Andy, and that is that fossil fuels are foundational to the profitable functioning of this capitalist imperialist system. Did it have to be that way? No. But this is how it has evolved. And what that means is that there's huge, huge amounts of investment capital that are tied up, you know, in pipeline, in infrastructure, you know, the transport, in the ways in which the whole industrial grid and agriculture with the use of petrochemical fertilizers and the way it works under capitalism is that you don't just write that off. We're talking about billions and billions, you know, in the fossil fuel industry alone. That investment has to be recouped. And you have bank loans, profit earning, yielding bank loans. All of this that has been sunk into not just the fossil fuel industry, but the whole way in which this economy and society are structured. And if you kind of say, oh, we're going to kind of say no to this. We're going to pull the plug on it. You know, that would unleash an economic earthquake in terms of the functioning of this system. Second, as we talked about, the fossil fuel is essential to the strategic military functioning of this system. In other words, the whole enforcement structure, the military machine, the fleets, the bombs, the whole way in which this global system is enforced, that is U.S. imperialism, dominant position, that relies on a military, you know, that is fueled by fossil fuel. And you have something else, a political reality, and that is you have a section of the ruling class, the Republic fascists, who are the climate deniers, who are not going to be well disposed, you know, to pulling the plug, you know, on fossil fuel. So, you know, these are, you know, underlying factors, you know, that tell you that there is no way that there's going to be an order. Remember, we started this interview off with the discussion of mandates. There's no mandate to stop fracking. There's no mandate, you know, to dismantle, you know, the oil pipelines. There's no mandate to say, well, we're not going to have a military that straddles the globe, you know, that consumes oil this way. So this is all a way of saying that it is foundational to the economic, profitable economic functioning, the supply chains, you know, that exist in the third world, the sweatshops, you know, the ships that transport these goods. All of this is wrapped up in fossil fuel.
As people are been conditioned to think in this society today, you couldn't even win people to do this because, first off, this you were describing this whole military machine, and people expect to have inexpensive goods. And you were saying earlier in a previous section of this interview that this global supply chain runs on these super tankers that are use a tremendous amount of oil. People want cheap goods. They want they get outraged when prices go up just a little bit. Panic sets in. People have their private cars, and people believe that America are the good guys and should be able to do whatever they want to the rest of the world as long as we have a good life here. Or in a more dominant way, they don't even think about their relationship to the rest of the world. So there's a whole ideological component that would have to be that you would need is to in order for people to even to support the kinds of thing you're saying that the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, would never do, which is basically you're saying shut down the oil industry and the defense, the U.S. military. That undermines the whole kettle of fish. And maybe we can come at it more by getting into this second question.
Andy, I just want to say that, the point you're making is a very important one. You know, the whole so-called consumer society
right. That
exists in the U.S. is both a source of profit and super profit. You know, when you see that the Walmart price, for instance, that people count on, you know, is premised on, you know, savage exploitation of people throughout the world. And then the transport of those goods, you know, requires fossil fuel. So you have a situation in this economy and society where there's almost two cars per household. And there's been a statistic that if the rest of the world were to have the same standard of living as the United States, you would need five Earths of resources and materials to sustain that. So this is unsustainable. But as you said, people don't think in these terms because it's whoever has the most toys at the end of the day. This is the ethos that is drilled into people, that there has to be a new model of an iPhone in order for me to be a full human being. You know, this is the mindset, you know, that exists. And what underlies that is everything that we've been talking about. A system of exploitation, and fossil fuels is very much, you know, at the font of that.
So this is important that this sort of me culture, the rampant and parasitic individualism in this country is tied to the system that's all tied in with this kind of environment. And it runs counter to what most people on another part of their thinking would like to see, where the earth continues, where there is diversity of species. But this connection means we have a lot of struggle to wage with people. I'd like, though, to move to how would a revolutionary society be able to go about working to solve this?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the first thing is a revolutionary society would put an end to a situation where you have these large, you know, mega corporations, you know, that are ruling the economy and are making the investment decisions based on what's profitable. So what's happening in a new liberatory socialist society is that you are able, because you have socialist ownership of the resources of society, the technological capacities of society, you have the ability now to rationally plan, you know, what is needed for the betterment of society and humanity. We need more housing. We need health care. We need a different kind of energy grid. And you go to work on that and you have the ability to do it. Look, here's what happens under the current system. You know, you have these scientists, for instance, who have issued these alarms about global warming, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These scientists are not just telling us, you know, what time it is in terms of this crisis. They're also telling us what needs to be done now, urgently, in terms of the transport system, in terms of energy, in terms of how we live and how we commute. Those scientists are cooperating with each other on a global scale, but they can only go so far. You know, the climate change report was reviewed, vetted by members of the fossil fuel industry. I mean, that's how obscene this is. You have people, right, who have all kinds of incredible proposals that are actionable, you know, to transform our energy system, you know, the existing energy system here and in other parts of the world rapidly to renewable, to solar, to geothermal, to wind. But this goes nowhere under the system. These proposals go nowhere because they have to be profitable. They have to be mediated by banks that gather up the investment capital. They have to show immediate return. So you have people, scientists, engineers with proposals that go nowhere. You have people in all walks of life whose creativity, whose determination goes nowhere. They're locked out of any kind of meaningful solution to these problems. You know, like, look, people may watch the show, you know, Shark Tank, you know, where they have entrepreneurs, right? And, you know, one of the first questions they ask people with an idea, most of the ideas are not very, you know, bold or visionary, and they're not dealing with environmental issues, but some of them do. But one of the first questions they ask them is, do you have a patent?
Do you have a patent on this?
Anything proprietary about it? Do you have a patent?
Jeff, is it patented?
Do you have a way to monetize that idea? But under socialism, these ideas become the common property. They're not a source of private profit and advancement. So you can go to work on these problems, and you go to work on these problems, you know, with a global perspective, that this is for the interest and the betterment of humanity and the protection of the planet. And the Constitution of the New Socialist Republic in North America, you know, has made this integral and central to what a new economy would look like. We proceed from the interest of world humanity, the resources, the technology, the know-how. This is to serve the betterment of humanity, the advance of revolution throughout the world, and the protection of the environment. And you're going to challenge people in the new society to see their relationship to each other and to nature in a qualitatively different way. That we are a planet that is facing this existential peril. And we have a responsibility to become caretakers of this planet. And now you can work on these problems in a way that gives you a chance. And I do want to make this point. There's no guarantee that we can save the planet, but this is our only chance to do it. And Babovikian has carved out, you know, a strategy for making this revolution. And he has analyzed why we are in a rare time when this revolution becomes more possible because of a ruling class that's at war with itself. And a huge possibility is opening up, Andy, for us to make revolution in the country that is the greatest source the carbon emissions in the atmosphere.
Raymond, I'd like some of your thoughts about how this environmental crisis is impacting in and feeding into and could be part of the conditions by which a revolutionary people in a revolutionary situation could be forged.
You know, Andy, we started early in the interview about, you know, what is the state of the planet right now? You know, I have a phrase, the foreboding summer of 2022, and we are seeing record droughts throughout the world. We're seeing wildfires, you know, in California. We're seeing, you know, flooding on a scale unseen before. And as I mentioned, you know, you have a situation right now in the world where over 100 million people are refugees, you know, forced to evacuate their homes. And hundreds of millions more people will be in that situation as this climate crisis intensifies. And what we've been getting at here is that this climate act is not simply inadequate, but it is part of the problem, not part of the solution. It is prolonging this dependency on oil, and it is not a program for a transition to a green economy. It is not a program to collaborate and unite with the people of the world. And yet people are experiencing all of the effects of a global, a planetary environmental crisis that is threatening the very ecosystems that make life possible on this planet. And if people can wrestle with the kinds of ideas that we're putting forth here, the analysis of why the Biden plan is not a plan to rescue this planet, and if people can wrestle with the fact that there is an alternative to this, what Bob Avakian has charted out, especially in this constitution for a new socialist republic in North America. You know, people see the Democrats, they see the Republican fascists, but they don't see in the main right now that there is an actual viable visionary alternative to this that gives us the chance, not the guarantee, to go to work on this crisis. And if people are wrestling with this, if people are being challenged by this, if people are engaging with the new interview with Bob Avakian from earlier this year, if people are going to that constitution and looking at the episodes on this show, see that there is an actual alternative, then that can become a profound mood changer in a time when people are lapsing into all of this, you know, grabbing hold of false hope on the one hand and hopelessness on the other. And I do think that maybe my message here is what Bob Avakian has called hope on a scientific basis. And that hope on a scientific basis actually is expressed and embodied in this constitution for a new socialist republic. The principles of socialist sustainable development, this can make an enormous difference on bringing forward a revolutionary people in a time of accelerating and cascading climate crisis.
Okay, Raymond, it's been good to have you on the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show. The interview over these last weeks is really a real contribution to people being able to understand what the problem we face is and what is the solution. So I look forward to seeing you again. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it, and I look forward to more discussion.
All right, so that was Andy Z of the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show interviewing Raymond Latta. That was part three on the environmental emergency. For the full article that Raymond was speaking on, you can visit revcom.us, the website, or see the full interview at youtube.com/therevcoms, where the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show is broadcast every Thursday night and available all the time. I'm the co-host of that show. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I'm so happy to be the guest host today for the Michael Slate show, which you are listening to right now. For our final segment, we're going to dive right in. This is a reflection from me on Bill Russell and the leadership of Bob Avakian.
I knew nothing about Bill Russell, the great basketball player and civil rights activist, before I read about him on the pages of RevCom after he passed away recently. But after that, I went on a bit of a jag learning about him. And around this same time, a friend and comrade of mine reread an essay from Bob Avakian in the book Basics titled A Leap of Faith and A Leap to Rational Knowledge. Two very different kinds of leaps, two radically different worldviews and methods. And we wrangled with this some together. So these two things together got me thinking more deeply about the unparalleled scientific communist leadership that Bob Avakian provides. What a game changer this is for humanity's ability to get free, and the importance of all of us who want to contribute to that process, consciously and continually deepening our ability to apply the same consistently scientific method and approach that BA models, while bringing forward more and more others to do the same. Let me explain. After reading about Bill Russell at RevCom.us, I was particularly interested in what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had written about him as well. Then I followed the links in Jabbar's pieces, then a few more links, and later I listened to an old interview that Terry Gross did with Russell on NPR. As the pieces on RevCom noted, Russell played a tremendous role in speaking up against racism and oppression throughout his life. But the biggest thing I learned about Russell as a player was that he was not only an incredible athlete, but he was always the smartest guy on the court. He'd play mind games.
West all alone. Look at Russell come down. And what a play by Russell!
He would psych them that every time they would go to the middle, they'd look, where's Russell?
Russell blocked shots without blocking them because people wouldn't take shots because they were afraid to take them. He changed the whole game.
One star player recalled how he took a shot and Russell blocked him. He took the shot again and Russell blocked him again. By the third time, this guy missed the shot because he was busy looking around to see where Russell was.
I went around my man, got him for a layup, and he blocked a couple of shots. Oh, man, then the next time I got around him, I missed a layup looking for him.
Russell played for the Boston Celtics from 1956 to 1969 and was a player coach for the last three of those years. Apparently, the great rivalry of that time was between Wilt Chamberlain, who was an aggressive and record scorer, and Russell, who was the ultimate team player, more known for his intellectual mastery of the game. I watched the two of them interviewed together. Russell was extremely precise in breaking down how he approached play against Chamberlain.
I could never play him the same way two games in a row, because it would not work. And so through the whole time we played against each other, every game was different.
In contrast, Chamberlain was far less theoretical and even teased Russell for being so intellectual in his answers.
He talks long on his points. That's why
when Terry Gross asked Russell how he drilled his team when he coached the Celtics, Russell started by explaining an exercise where they stretched their arms out to the side slowly to identify precisely how far their peripheral vision extended. Then they drilled fast break rebounds where he'd jump, grab the ball, and throw it to someone in the right color jersey who would know exactly where the outer limits of Russell's peripheral vision reached. This way, Russell never had to turn his head before passing. This enabled them to break faster than anyone else. The other teams couldn't keep up. Russell said this cut down on how many shots he personally could score because he'd rarely make it down to the other end of the court before his teammates had scored, usually in less than 6 seconds. Terry noted that Russell was an incredible jumper, but that Chamberlain was a full 5 inches taller. So how did he guard Chamberlain? Russell started by saying that because he was left-handed and Chamberlain was right-handed, Russell didn't have to reach across his body to block him. So that gave him back 3 inches. Then he broke down how you can jump higher when you're blocking than you can when you're shooting, because when you're shooting, the jump becomes part of and is constrained by using its power to project into the shot. So that gave Russell 3 more inches back. All of a sudden, he had the advantage. But Russell stressed he could never play Wilt the same way for long, or Wilt would catch on and overpower him. So Russell never tried to block every shot. Sometimes he'd block. Sometimes he'd just move in close to try to force Wilt to adjust his stance before shooting. Russell would aim for something as slight as forcing Wilt to pivot a mere 2 inches, enough to throw off Wilt's shot and make him miss maybe half the time. but not enough for Wilt to pick up on why he was missing more than usual. This would get inside Wilt's head and throw him off further. You get the idea. So how does all this relate to where I started? To Bob Avakian's leadership and his essay on how people learn and know about the world. In his essay on two leaps, B.A. breaks down how one can make a leap from knowledge that is derived from perception, that is literally what one can see or directly experience, to rational knowledge, that is identifying the patterns in what is perceived, and identifying the essential character of different things and the underlying dynamics that hold them together beyond what is outwardly apparent. An example of this that B.A. gives is how, to someone unfamiliar with the game, football can at first seem like a bunch of guys just running around, running into each other in funny outfits. But after observing it for a while, gathering perceptual knowledge, and identifying the patterns, one can make a leap to rational knowledge, to understanding what the rules of football are, and to understanding the game as a whole. After giving other examples and showing how this applies in all realms of reality, B.A. makes this point. Quote, "The understanding of reality that is gained through the leap from perceptual to rational knowledge becomes, in turn, the basis, the foundation from which further perceptual knowledge that is accumulated is analyzed and synthesized to make further leaps of this kind, from perceptual to rational knowledge yet again and then again. So the acquiring of knowledge by individuals and by society and humanity overall is not a one-time thing, but an ongoing process." End quote. Wrestling with this essay from B.A. at the same time that I was learning about Bill Russell made me very conscious of how much science Russell was bringing to bear all the time to the whole game. He didn't just make the leap from perceptual to rational knowledge once to grasp the rules of the game, or just make a collection of further leaps to grasp certain strategies or certain plays. But all the time, he was bringing to bear the full framework of what he understood about the game as a whole, about the various dynamics, about the different particular teams, about the different particular players, about different particular plays, and about how all this came together and what was key at any given time to drive towards his overarching goal of leading his team to win. Certainly, in the moment, Russell was doing all of this more or less reflexively, but his ability to do that was rooted in having deeply internalized all of that theory and developed the ability at a very high level to bring it to bear when thinking on his feet. This parallels how in the new communism, Bob Avakian takes apart and breaks down all the scientific work and the method that was the basis on which he was able to pivot in the moment when some dogmatic nationalist crashed a talk he was giving back in the 1970s. They raised up a map of the states where black people were concentrated in an effort to challenge what B.A. was putting forward about how the liberation of black people was bound up with the communist revolution in this country. But rather than being thrown off by this, B.A. was able to utilize their map to further break down the major changes in where black people mostly lived, having moved through the Great Migration from the rural countryside in the South, where they had largely been sharecroppers, into the cities and urban areas, mainly as proletarian workers at that point. And B.A. used this to make an even deeper case for what this revealed about the revolution that's needed. At one point, B.A. even asked these nationalists to hold their map up a little higher so he could make this point even more clear to those who were gathered. To get the full example, you really have to read it in The New Communism. It's in Chapter 4, and it is worth it. But the point here is that this is a great example of the art of extremely high-level communist leadership. It's filled with intangibles and a certain kind of poetry on the basis of being deeply rooted in science. It's an example of the tremendous confidence and creativity and daring and real optimism on that scientific foundation. The same thing applies to B.A.'s leadership in an ongoing way. If you look over the outline at the back of The New Communism, you'll see a breakdown of all the major dimensions of the new communism that B.A. has forged. Each of these is important in its own right, but they're also not static. They're not merely proofs that the system cannot be reformed and needs to be overthrown and replaced with a radically different system, though they certainly do prove this. These breakthroughs are also part of the operational theoretical framework that BA applies in an ongoing way to analyzing the world and how it can be changed. All of this, for example, is what has enabled him to see in an unparalleled way the depth of the crisis that this system is currently in and how this has given rise to splits within the ruling class that cannot be resolved on the terms that have held this system together for nearly 150 years. This is what has enabled him to see the explosiveness of what is being fought out today in a concentrated way around women's right to abortion, whether women will be enslaved or emancipated. This is what has enabled Bob Avakian to analyze that this is a rare time when revolution is more possible. This is what has enabled him to lay out a roadmap for wrenching something truly emancipating, a real revolution, out of this situation that is right now accelerating towards something terrible, and so much more. In this light, there's tremendous importance for all of us who want to contribute to the revolution that is necessary to emancipate humanity, to not only continually dig into and deepen our grasp of the new communism that Bob Avakian has forged in all its particular dimensions and as a whole, but most of all, to take up the same method and approach that he does, to continually develop our ability to apply this science in a living, operational, and ongoing way, to do this collectively, and to increasingly bring forward waves of new revolutionary leaders capable of the same. So one final point about Bill Russell. Back in 2001, when Terry Gross interviewed him, she asked Russell if he could still jump. Russell explained that his body doesn't move like it used to. But, he said, I still jump. I jump for joy. And he went into how important it is to never give up jumping for joy. And this, too, relates to the leadership of BA and to the kind of world and beauty that the revolution he is fighting for will bring into being.
All right. So that was a commentary from myself. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I am pleased to be your guest host here on the Michael Slate Show. We have made it to the end of the show, and I want to thank you for hanging with us. Thank you to Gary Baca for engineering. Thank you to Henry Carson for producing. And we are going to send you out with a beautiful song from Shakib Mozadek, an Afghani singer, and Miles Soleil of Outer National, in honor of people rising up in Iran in particular, but also breaking the chains and challenging oppression of women and all forms of oppression everywhere in the world. We will go out with that, and I will talk to you next week. در شهر پرخور شاید دگر